Welcome to the Discovery Files, episode 6. This is the second half of the interview with Julian Woodcock. We talked about the discovery of Invincible, and we decided to break it into two episodes so that it would be a little bit easier for people to access.
When you look back at your time, Julian, is there one thing that stands out as like a challenge, like, or your biggest challenge in that role? Like, what do you think was the thing that really, you know, you had to grind against for a while to kind of get done?
People management.
I was about to say, I'm sure I played part in that.
And look, to that point, I accept that I was probably quite abrasive. I have had that feedback before. And it's never intentional against individuals. It's always just I get target fixated. I want to get the job done. So first and foremost, I'm looking at the objective. And it's not that I'm dismissing of people on the way. I'm very direct. Like I don't necessarily want a long answer. I usually ask a question that a yes or no answer will suffice. And then I get a long response and then I get a bit impatient. And it's not because I'm intending to be rude or anything like that, but I usually have a thing. Well, I want to get to here. So if I ask these 3, 4, 5 questions, we'll get to a point. And sometimes it can be a bit slow, and that's when I can get a bit frustrated. And I have a tendency to cut in. I have a tendency to talk over people. And again, that's something I'm aware of and I've learned over time.
You had told me at one point, and at the time, I was kind of like, what? And then I thought about it, and I've actually said very similar things since then. But I was going over some, I don't even know what the issue was, but I was going over some issue. And you interrupted and you said, Scott, do you have a proposed solution to this? Because if you have a question without a solution, it's a complaint, and I'm not a complaint department. At the time, I was like, oh my gosh. And it was something along those lines. But it made me really think about it, because what it made me realize is you actually were looking to solve it. You wanted to figure out a way around it, but you wanted me first to think about what possible solutions there could be. And so it's actually been one of the questions that's kind of guided parts of my career is to really be, our goal is to overcome these obstacles, not to complain about them, right? And so I don't know that
you almost got it right there. It's the phrase I use is a problem without a solution is just a complaint. What I stand by, because we're out there to find solutions to fix. So And before you mentioned that, so I was talking about what did I find difficult? People management. So I've come from a decade of working in Central Asia, culturally very different, very much, I'll coin the phrase, yes, boss kind of response. Whether you're right or wrong, the people below you wouldn't challenge you. You'd just be given a direction. You'd be giving the direction and they would follow it to the point. To a company's detriment, a project detriment, you wouldn't get that pushback. So it was always in those circumstances about just getting things achieved, getting the data sets, and then we would usually outsource into developed worlds and consultants and things a lot of the interpretation. So it's about data gathering. Moving to Chennai, managing a team and a much more structured setting, performance reviews, performance management, succession, annual reviews, bonuses, like that. This is a huge level of structure that I'd not had to be engaged in for the previous part of my career, partly because I came through juniors and a lot of juniors don't have the place. And then I inadvertently ended up at Goldfields. And even then I was managing an in-country team of locals. We didn't have we had one other expat out with us at the time. But yeah, so the amount of work that was involved behind the scenes, working with the HR department, talking about the expectations, how your performance managed, not in a way because someone's not performing, but in terms of annual reviews, balanced scorecards, you'll remember those, Scott. So we have these annual things. We put a lot of effort in that, but then it gave people goals and objectives. So we probably did overcook it, take it maybe a bit too far. But then again, by the same token, it gave us a framework. If we're definitive of what's to be achieved, people can work towards getting a bonus. And I was all for everyone getting bonuses. But I very much like to have something to work to and something to fall back and say, well, this is what we set out to do. Look, things can change and we can massage that down the track. But let's have a goal And then once we've got a goal, we blew it. So I hadn't done that level of serious engagement with people, or I'd managed large teams, but they'd generally be large teams of different nationalities, different speakers. I could converse in Russian, but not to a high level. There were a whole load of other aspects that probably clouded that people management when I was working overseas. Then moving to Australia and moving to St. Ives, that came a very key critical component and something that you're always growing in and always learning about and took forward into subsequent roles.
And so Julian, how do you, the reason why I asked the challenge question is I was kind of trying to lead you into exactly what you said as a people management, because, you know, I've done it the opposite way. I've worked in this environment, gone overseas, and I think you have to kind of cater your ability to communicate with, you know, like particularly a local workforce, because they will just say yes, no matter what you ask for, right? And you soon realize that it's in their, you know, like it's to their detriment to say yes. So when you deal with these teams, one of the things that came out was with Aisha's interview and even the conversations I have with Scott is that there was this level of, I'd say, healthy tension in the team. Yeah, you know, like every big team has to have it. Like you can't make a team without having, you can't make a big team without having tension, right? Because it's different personalities, different management styles, all of those things. How did you go about handling that on like an individual level? Did you like the fact that you had a team with this level of kind of healthy tension, like competition for ideas? Or is that something you had to kind of like work on yourself and make it part of your management style?
Yeah, I guess if it doesn't come naturally, and I would say for me it doesn't come naturally, it is draining and it's hard. You've got to put conscious effort into it. Some people are just natural people leaders, and I wouldn't put myself into that category. So you've got to focus on it. I think what you have to do is you've got to have a and this goes without saying really, but you've got to have a good level of respect, whether you're a leader of a team or whether, I think even more importantly, when you're a member of a team. A leader obviously has to be respectful, but they also have to make the tough calls, which will never appease everyone. You cannot please everyone. And I get that from having a family of five children. It's impossible to please everyone. I mean, even though the two older two have moved on, I've got twin boys, and yeah, always one of them is going to be upset no matter what decision is made. Like, what movie do you want? What do you want to watch in the show? What do you want for dinner? It's like, yeah. So you have to be fair. So on the management side, but I think in a team level, you've got to always maintain that respect. You don't have to like everyone. You don't have to be going out for meals and everyone. But it is better when you've got a team, like a football team or a cricket team or whatever, that everyone gels together and they go and do things collectively. But it's wishful thinking for that to always be the case. So, I think.
And so in that vein, how do you deal with strong personalities in a team as well? You know, because one of the things that can come. Yeah, that's right.
Deal with me, Scott. I don't know.
I don't get offended easily anymore.
So.
The reason why I ask this, I think like in exploration groups, I think that is, I think it's a common problem, right? That, you know, like you, I think in order to have that kind of diversity of thought, you also have to accept that you're going to have diversity of individuals, right? That's like, you can't have one without the other. And so I think in big teams, often, you know, the pressure to kind of regress to the mean, to become kind of like the model kind of employee, I think is tough, right? So how do you manage that?
Yeah, look, there's a load of psychological ways, and I've learned this through just coming up with this. There's a process called life cycle inventory, and you fill in all these forms and you answer all these questions, and you get classified as one of four different colors. And all I remember is there's red and I'm red, but I'm joking. There's green and there's blue and there's yellow, and there's some people are the people, and some people are the direct people. And for any team to be effective, you actually need all the elements. It's you can't, if you veer too much towards one side, for example, everyone's character is more about making sure that everyone feels included and happy, and that they'll worry more about the individual's feelings than if they're doing something wrong, that they shouldn't be testing that target, rather than speak up and say, your target's no good, we shouldn't work on that, they'll be worried about how they're going to feel about that, which is important. You've got to think about the individual, but in a team that's only loaded with those kind of people, you're just going to be spinning your wheels. You're only going to be drilling things because you don't want to upset anyone. You need the people who'll call out and say, yeah, that's no good, or why are you doing that? And if you've got a teams of all of that kind of people, they're just going to be forever arguing that theirs is the best and that, no, this is why I should be doing that. You'll never get anywhere either. So you need that balance. So there's a lot to be said in big organizations, I think, for doing those kinds of studies with those bigger teams to get the right mix and the right set of skills. And that set of skills can change depending on where you are at the life cycle of a project, or where you are with the needs for either growing a team or shrinking a team. So management should be cognizant of that, and should be, I think the leaders of those teams should be aware that they need to change or move people around in the team. Don't be afraid of change. Don't be afraid of reorganization. Don't be afraid of saying you got it wrong. We did this change and it's not working and we need to change it again. Give it enough time to make sure you establish it. But yeah, I think anything can evolve. And I think anyone would be extremely arrogant to say that, oh, you get it right first time and that's it, it's going to work.
Yeah. It's all about being flexible, recognizing the issue quickly, and then decisively moving forward, right? Because what I've found over time is, you know, you get into this, if you are always analyzing, you get into that paralysis by analysis, right? And people don't make a decision because they're afraid of making an imperfect one, as opposed to, you know, striking out, making a decision, saying, this is what we're going to do, recognizing there's a flaw, and then pivoting and changing direction rapidly, right?
I guess that's the point, is that, yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to hear your perspective on this, Julian, because you went through kind of the life cycle of the project. Is that, I think at times, like, you know, your management style somewhat has to change along the way of like the life cycle of the project as well, right? Like, you know, like at the start, you might be the one that has to decide, you know, like which opportunities come in, which opportunities go out. But then once the project becomes a certain point where you have to involve other departments, you know, it becomes more of a consultation process, right? Like, you know, you got to work with these other departments. Like the resource thing you're saying, you know, like is a classic, right? Where, you know, like for a long time, the project sits under your control so you can define exactly what it looks like. But then all of a sudden it goes outside of your control to another department. And then all of a sudden they apply a completely different definition to what the value or whatever the opportunity you have. And so I think, yeah, like that's kind of, I guess, the you know, what it's kind of trying to lead to is that I think what comes across is that, you know, I'm not sure, you know, obviously there's a benefit of hindsight where you can kind of look at yourself, but I think it was quite important in the fact that you were somewhat aware of these challenges along the way. And maybe your time in Central Asia had kind of guided you to that more consultation process, you know, like you're talking about the year that you spent before you came to St. Ives. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like maybe you kind of got a, like, you know, you built some tools to be able to do that, and maybe that helped you in that process. But this is something I think some managers struggle with when the project kind of develops to a certain degree as well.
Yeah, you've got to be prepared to recognize when you reach out and need assistance, whether it be, look, probably one of the hardest things to do is if an individual feels that they're inadequate in their role in some capacity, it's very difficult to put your hand up and say, I need help in this because I'm not able to do what I need to do. So that's one aspect, but touching on some of your points there, like one of the other key things is, and we've talked about it before, is reaching out to the other disciplines. So engineering, for example, I don't know if the team I work with realized how much time I spent engaging with the engineering team and the engineering mm-hmm. department, because, and it was more heads, it wasn't the operating engineers on a day-to-day basis, but it was the teams that were involved in doing effectively the open pit optimizations and the underground stope optimizations, and working with them and getting things in place. So it's like having the next person down the track ready to catch the ball. So working out when they're going to be available, what their workloads are, because they've got annual resource and reserve generation. They've got mine designs happening on operating mines. They've got all these different things in the air as well that are, team would not necessarily be cognizant of what's going on in these other spheres. Yeah. So it's having the foresight and the forethought of what are the next steps down the track, and going and fostering those relationships, building them together, a time calling payments. It's like, yeah, well, we've got this thing happening. Can we squeeze this one in? What can you do? Did it a lot with the environmental team, did it a lot with the engineering teams. And at times the safety teams as well. Safety was always paramount and critical. But getting those teams on board to preempt where you would get resistance at different levels within the organization because there'd be a different levels of perception of risk. So, for example, building all the causeways. Can you imagine some of the people coming back like, what are you doing? Well, we've got six trucks and we're building a track that's 3 meters, 4 meters wide with a 1 meter drop off on the edge onto a salt lake. And I'm amazed that we actually got away without having to build buns down the side of those tracks. But it wasn't just a case, oh, we don't want to build them. It would slow things down. And it's about managing risks. I've got an analogy at the moment that just typifies it. Like, you have to be risk tolerant. You have to have risk awareness and you have to do risk assessments. A risk assessment, you can identify a risk, but if the likelihood is low, you should be willing to accept a risk. And I think that's what we determined in these instances. And we did have, I don't know if it was on Invincible, but we did have 1 year, we changed our earthworks contractor and we had one of these trucks. It was an articulated Moxie and the back part of the truck, the wheel had dropped off the side or the causeway had gone soft and it tipped. So that the cab went sort of on at 45 degrees, but the back had rolled over. And yeah, you can imagine the fallout from that. And then it was, oh, we've got to have buns on everything. So, well, hold on, let's look at it. I can't remember the outcome might have been we had to have buns on everything. I can't recall. But then they start saying, well, the bun has to be half the wheel height. Before you know it, you're building a road that's 6 meters wide to accommodate to the extra width you need to allow a bun to go on the side.
And that's right.
Just redo all the permits,
Cascades. And then in the meantime, we've been pulled from the other direction to say, well, you're going to be measured on your in-ground expenditure cost. And if causeways aren't deemed an in-ground expenditure cost, well, I'm spending a disproportionate amount of money on causeways. It's not about the money. You've got to manage the risk, but you have to have a risk tolerance. And the analogy I was going to use in all this that I just start off with, I've just had a new boiler fitted at my house. And now the Australian standard is you've got a boiler that makes hot water, kicks it out at 60 degrees. But the government have determined that 60 degrees is too hot and it could scald you. So you have to put a tempering valve after the boiler to reduce it to 50. So you're heating water, making it hot, and sticking it through a valve that makes it cold again. It's like, what? Can't I just be aware that, oh, that water's hot?
It's an interesting thing, right? Because I remember coming from the United States, and it's changed in the United States since then, but I was so impressed with the safety at St. Ives because I felt it was very real world, very conscious of the actual outcomes and things like that. And I felt like we had a phenomenally safe time there, and maybe I'm misremembering it, but it was an interesting like eye-opener to me where it didn't feel that it was burdensome to achieve that either because it had that balance of risk versus acceptance of risk. And I've worked on projects from the complete opposite where I felt like that it was in danger of killing people to projects that you couldn't suffer a paper cut because like the paper would be locked up, right? so it's an interesting balance, right, to achieve that. And I go back to the time from like the first drill hole to like an inferred resource, I think it was under a year. I think it was like 11 months or something like that. And then I think it was like, I remember looking in the paper and it was like 3 years after that it was a mine, right? It was something like that, like 4 years total.
34 months from the first diamond hole to digging rock.
That's incredible. But I look at how much has that impacted St. Ives as a site, right? Because that's probably by now one of the main producers, if not the main producer of gold. And how easily that project could have gone differently, right? You know, where if from the start, you had said, like, there's no way we're building a causeway on a salt lake. Are you insane? This is ridiculous. And it could have just died right then, right? Like, it could have been, well, we're not going to drill a diamond program on something that's 5 kilometers away from the nearest land because it's going to be too hard to build a causeway. That goes back to that same conversation of risk tolerance, right? Where I hate to say you need to be aggressive at all times, cause I don't know what the right answer is, but I look at it and like that worked, whatever it was that you did, it worked, right? And so I'm just kind of curious.
Like Scott and I talked about this, right? Like when I hear this story, the thing that comes across to me is that how easy it could have been for management to say no along the way, right? Like that they could have easily said no, right? Like, you know, it was I can't remember the name. Was it Incredible? Like the other Discovery that was in kind of like a similar area, but was like off,
yeah,
like,
you know, like, down the
like was like off Broadway of the type of deposits and the type of things. And, you know, like money was spent drilling that and nothing came out of it. And he had Invincible, which is again off Broadway. And yeah, so it could have been easy for someone to say, nah, you know, it could be just be another Incredible. Don't waste your time on it. Go somewhere else. You know, like the whole Causeway thing, like, you know, someone could have just said, nah, you know, we don't want to spend 30 or 40 cents of every dollar building causeways to go out and drill these things. You know, like, to me, it just seems like there were so many points in the story where it could have been so easy for someone to just say, nah, we're not doing it. And that could have been the end of the whole story. Do you think the same? Like, do you think the same, Julian? Or do you think, like, that's not a right interpretation?
I think to that, it's having the right person in the role that's making the decision. So I would say I was fortunately given a very free rein to manage the team and the budget accordingly. And I'm risk tolerant. I'm risk tolerant in my life. I'm risk tolerant in my work. That doesn't mean I'm risky and I tolerate unsafe behavior and those sorts of things. But I don't see, they never once appeared to me barriers that would prevent us from achieving. That might have been a bit through maybe some ignorance, but in the end, every day you drive in and out of that site, you drive along a causeway that's been built and divided Lake Lefroy in half that connects the North Shore to the South Shore, and I think it's 20 k's long, that has got a power line going alongside it with pits littered across. So it wasn't like we were breaking new ground in concept of mining on a salt lake. So that there was a history there that kind of gave you an ignorance to any perceived potential barriers. I would say as well, in terms of what's shaped me for my risk tolerance and profile, I'd come, probably one of my most extreme roles was working at Kupol in the Russian Arctic. And we were in the absolute middle of nowhere. The nearest town was the Arctic port of Pevek, 200 plus kilometers north of us. And every year we had to build an ice road. It took a month or plus to build an ice road, like ice road truckers style. We had a whole load of Canadians and Americans leading the teams to build them out to the port of Pevek in the winter. And then you'd truck in a year's worth of supplies. So, and we were mining, building and operating underground mine in the complete middle of nowhere, frozen wasteland. So coming from that sort of environment, I didn't see these as barriers or problems.
Yeah, it's like 5 kilometers? Like that shouldn't even be a question.
Look, there are always challenges and difficulties, and you've got to look at it. And I'm working actually on a project now. I'm on a board of another company, and we've got projects in California. They've got challenges. The access is going to be difficult. We're going to do the first round of drilling. We've got environmental considerations we've got to think about. But we just have to look at it. And then, interestingly enough, I was having a conversation with someone recently about some holes potentially to drill in a certain area. And I looked at those and went, they're going to be really, really hard to get to. Like, what's the reward and the prize of those holes? We're focused on drilling up in another area. This is kind of down here. If these don't work, is this going to work? Well, if this one to the south's not going to work, maybe we should leave that for another day because we need the bigger picture to work first. So it flips both ways. But yeah, having... To your question, there were certainly a whole load of things that could have prevented it, but I think it got momentum quite quickly. So
yeah.
The fact that we had such good success with the first diamond holes meant we could get, and we had a late diamond, and we went out and did some more, and we reinforced that. And then that gave us the, essentially, look, I had to get approval. I couldn't just go and hire a digger and start building and digging holes, but it gave us the confidence that we had a size or something.
I mean, I think one of the things you say, like, yeah, like I want to say this diplomatically, like you say your ignorance in these things. I think, you know, like having talked to a number of people previously that have been involved in discoveries, I think this is a theme that sometimes comes up, right, where they say, I just didn't know anything else, so or I hadn't encountered this problem, so I didn't even know it was a problem. And so, yeah, like, so some people just don't even look at it. And I think this also came across from like Aisha, right? Like, yeah, like Aisha, this was probably her first proper role. She didn't really understand the importance of like the deposit models in St. Ives. You know, she saw gold in a stratigraphic unit and she went, well, yeah, as long as I can map that unit, I can I can understand this ore body. You know, so that I think like sometimes a level of ignorance is actually a good thing as well.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, that's right.
And then conversely, I think you can't put enough dollar values on the experiences you had in going to some of these remote locations where it made what could have been an insurmountable obstacle for someone who was used to it just seem totally insignificant, right? And so I kind of think about how much of our previous experience colors our viewpoint of any project we ever work on again, both in terms of what not to do and what works well, and even what's a problem or what's not a problem. So it's kind of a fascinating topic, right? Where it's like, if you hadn't gone to Kyrgyzstan and to Russia, how differently Invincible would have looked, right?
Definitely.
So would you do anything different, Julian, now that you look back? Like, what would you do different?
But Invincible, probably no. I think that went extremely well and probably couldn't have gone better. And look, with the benefit,
I mean, the fact that you went from discovery to like whatever production in 3 years,
that's pretty good.
I think
pretty
good. The only thing I would do differently, which is with the benefit of hindsight, since the deposit has grown, is maybe gone a bit more aggressive, but. Even on reflection of that, we drilled early on, and I can't remember, Scott, if you were there at the time, probably maybe it was after. We very early on, we had the geology was contained within this mudstone unit with these loads. So we actually drilled what would be coined a director's special hole down the plunge, but it wasn't purely to get good results. It was to actually test the model of these stack vein sets and get these plunging chutes. So we drilled from the hanging wall to the footwall through the prospective horizon, but effectively perpendicular to the plunge of the chutes. And that was a big hole. I think that was like an 800 meter diamond hole. It wasn't an insignificant one. And that set the framework up early that we saw units at depth. And then we set and drilled these wide spaced fences with Navi drills. We spent millions of dollars doing this. I mean, on reflection, it's like I can only dream of doing that sort of thing in the company I'm working for now. But that was a pretty bullish move. And that, again, gave confirmation to subsurface depths. And so that's actually driven, and they've just all infilled and infilled. So what we probably didn't know at that time was credit the intercepts and get them into inferred resource. They were always left as potential resources, a subclassification below inferred, essentially we had in-house. So
yeah. Potential mineralization or something? I can't remember what the term for it is now.
It's for the risk-averse resource guys that won't allow you to classify something, even though you've
got... That's right.
So I probably would push to put that into resource maybe sooner. But no, I don't think there's any major changes I would have made. I think the site, like as an individual site, I don't believe there's been any discovery of this magnitude since Invincible. So that's like 14 plus years ago. They've had some wins on the way, I believe. I don't really say close to it or familiar with it. But when we had to downsize the team, I think it's the voluntary redundancy Scott was talking about. We basically got the budget chopped in two. And I did push really hard to try and not have that occur. And I pushed, we just built the team up. We literally, when I joined St. Ives, we did this strategic session where it was like, how do we get discovered? How do we find something new? We had a whole workshop on it and we set a plan together and we called it 3D. It was discover, develop, deliver, or in one of those orders. And that really saw us ratcheting the budget up, building up the team, putting the org chart together. So this was all part of that early, it's all coming back to me now. It's all putting back that early establishment of the team. And we literally built it all up and we had discovery success. And then 18 months later, we were ripping it down. And that frustrated me, it upset me. Personally, I pitched my case to the general manager, probably to my own detriment. I don't know if I could have fought any harder, but if I could have found a way to have achieved that team not getting dismantled, I think that would have paid dividends today, because we removed capacity. What invariably happens on these sites is you cut the budget. Well, guess where the budget gets cut? It gets cut in the project generation, because correct, they've got resources that they need to convert to reserve. So all the money they do get gets just spent on converting resources to reserve, and then they live hand to mouth. And arguably, if we'd maintained that path and had 5 years of funding, we could have really bolstered the pile. We may not have done. It's easy to turn around and say that, look what opportunity you missed. But yeah, that would probably be my biggest regret at site. And whether I could have done more, I don't know. But that the team got pulled back. And yeah, we were fortunately had a good discovery. If we hadn't had that good discovery, maybe they would have had to have thought differently about it. I don't know. Or maybe maybe they would have pulled up stumps in total and just put in a wind down plan for the site, and it wouldn't be there anymore. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I always find that it's strange, right? Like, I always think, I do a little bit of work with sports organizations, and when someone I kind of told them a story once, and they said that's kind of strange. It's like you have a championship winning team and you dismantle it the year after they win the championship. That seems a little bit strange. And I go, when you put it that way, I agree. It seems kind of strange. Normally you try to bolster that team further to try to take it. So yeah,
that's the industry norm too, right? That's almost everywhere. When they make a new discovery, they ramp down their greenfields or brownfields
generative side, yeah,
so that they can afford the drill out. And I was thinking about like NVK, being the right person at the right time. I remember I always laughed. We had XMS, and he would just war game these gigantic systems in there and be like, oh, it's gonna be 9 million ounces, which I think he was right on Invincible, right? But it's just kind of interesting that you go through this whole exercise with this team of people, and this guy happens to be there at that time and come up with, you think about Incredible is a great target too. The fact that they hit mineralization and things like that on the, was it the Speedway or the Zuleika Shear? I can't remember which, but it's just kind of interesting to think NVK would not have done well in a drill out environment, right? Cause he loved the early stage. And so how much of that team, the whole composition, probably wasn't super well suited for follow-on phases of reduced exploration spend and doing more resource conversion. And I think about that sometimes where it's like, how would things be different if we didn't, can that exploration effort and instead went, okay, maybe they're not going to do work at St. Ives, but maybe we'll see if we can send some of this team to Agnew or wherever else. Right. And, it's just interesting to think about when you have that, because I often think about that too, being one of my big regrets is just that shattering of that team, and it's like, what could we have done different? And maybe we would have found nothing, right? Who knows, right? Maybe it was just one off luck or whatever, but it's been an interesting thing to ponder over the years, is to say, how would St. Ives look today? And it's totally a rhetorical question, right? Maybe nothing would have been found differently, but it also feels like we got rid of so much good knowledge. I mean, you lose people like me and a little bit of dead weight goes out the door, but for the most part, there's so much good knowledge that site team is forever changed as a result of those people leaving. Right. So.
Yeah. Unfortunately it happens everywhere, but whatever side of the fence you lean on, there's some seriously good and essential resources that have been ripped apart, and that happens everywhere. It's just a function of decisions that are made at the time. But I would say, it's another one of those sort of typical phrases, the worst decision you can make is no decision. In the end, if you make a decision, you just then have to, you can't sit and forever dwell upon what could have been. You've just got to pick yourself up and move forwards. And that was one of the key requirements of my role, whether I agreed with or disagreed with, that was really supposed to be behind closed doors. And then in the end, I had to toe the line of what the company decision is and make the best out of a bad situation.
I mean, the reason why I brought this up, like, it's not, I don't think, if it comes across where I think you were the architect in that sense, that's not the intention of kind of saying it in that. The one thing that I find is, like, you know, there is this conversation in industry right now. You know, a lot of companies say, well, how do we get back to kind of like the culture where we have multiple discoveries? So companies like WMC or like BHP's exploration team in its heyday, all of these companies, they had this repeated kind of success, like CRA, in a period of, I think it's like, I can't exactly remember, but say in a decade, they went from the same team finding an iron ore deposit to finding diamonds, to finding a copper deposit, to finding, manganese, right? So, and I think that's maybe one of the ingredients we've kind of not, I realized is that, you got to keep people around, I think.
Yeah, people are a critical component for that continuity, but we are in a completely different environment operationally now.
I agree.
Certainly in Australia, but I think you could argue globally, just the social license to operate, the environmental stewardship, things are done differently now. Safe. Mm-hmm. There's a whole suite of things that elongate, stretch out that workflow that has to be followed in order to test targets. And
I agree.
I think
that's a good point, right? Like, you can't have a team sitting, like, the years that it takes now to go from discovery to production, I think are so long, you can't really necessarily maybe have that team sitting around, like the Knicks of the world or the dreamers, so to speak, in the exploration sense. You can't have them sitting around for that long.
I would advocate that for the big companies, And it'd be really interesting to see, and only the companies themselves will really know, but how have their budgets progressed with time with the inflationary costs, not inflation per se within the country, but the industry inflationary costs. So drilling's gone up, fuel's gone up, wages have gone. Have budgets kept pace? So is a $1 million exploration budget today, what does that translate to a 1990s exploration budget? Like,
like meters per year, right?
Yeah, I mean, intuitively, I think in-ground spend has gone down as a percentage of budget, right? Because you're spending more money on other things. Even like things like technology, probably technology takes a significant amount of your budget now than it probably previously did. So I think, there's just more pressure on that dollar to go elsewhere than necessarily into the ground at some point.
Oh, and it's layered up in many aspects. It's the environmental review, the heritage review, all of these things. It's an operational cost. So operational costs have gone up. Budgets probably haven't risen commensurate with that. And that just makes it more difficult. You need more holes in the ground. The only way you're going to find a deposit is holes in the ground. So you couple that with the low-hanging fruit's been taken. But I suppose there is a counter argument that techniques and methods should have improved sufficiently to be able to offset that a little bit. But it's a challenge that the industry is constantly facing. But people are critical to it. So bringing it back to the purpose of this talk, people are essential, and having the right people in the right roles and getting the most effective use of those people and resources. So I would always say, you got to deploy your resources effectively. It's strategy, whether it's in a military setting or whatever, right? You've got to deploy your resources effectively and utilizing your people to the best of their ability to get the most value and deliver with the objective.
Mm-hmm. So I guess as a kind of maybe close out question, what lesson have you taken for the rest of your career from what could be the last discovery to go from zero to production in 34 months?
What lesson have I taken? Never be afraid to test what you think is a good target. I think don't be drawn into the paradigms. Make your own paradigms. And I think, just be adventurous, be bold, be a risk taker. I think you've got to have that vision that what your conviction in what you're doing is correct or has an opportunity, should we say, not correct. In our case, it's more often than not incorrect. But having that vision that something can yield what you want it to yield. and go out there and put.
And even if you're not a risk taker, at least be risk tolerant, you know, which is a lesson I got out of this talk. Yeah. Like, yeah, that's a good one. Digging deep where the stories hide, through the hills and the mountains wide. Pickaxe swing and the earth unfolds, chasing dreams in the dirt and gold. Geology calling under our feet, secrets are buried in the rock and heat. With a heart full of wonder and a map in hand, exploring the treasures of this great land.